These lectures are part of the Superstar Teachers series. They are produced by The Teaching Company. The lectures on these tapes are titled Ideas in Western Culture, the Medieval and Renaissance Worlds, Part 2. The lecturer is Professor Ori Soltis. Professor Soltis is the director of the B'nai B'rith Klutznik National Jewish Museum in Washington, D.C., and adjunct assistant professor of fine arts at Georgetown University and of history at the Cleveland College of Jewish Studies. Professor Soltis studied classical literature and philosophy at Haverford College, Princeton University, and the Johns Hopkins University. He has lectured extensively at the Art Institute of Chicago, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, and other museums throughout the United States. Lecture 11, Street Language Becomes Literature.
When April with his shower is sweet with fruit, the draught of March has pierced unto the root and bathed each vein with liquor that has power to generate therein and sire the flower. When Zephyr also has with his sweet breath quickened again in every holt and heath the tender shoots and buds, and the young sun into the ram one half his course has run, and many little birds make melody that sleep through all the night with open eye, so nature pricks them on to ramp and rage, then do folk long to go on pilgrimage, and palmers to go seeking out strange strands to distant shrines well known in sundry lands. And so Chaucer's unfinished epic, The Canterbury Tales, begins. It begins as we know in spring. It begins when the west wind has started to blow. It begins when, in terms of astrology, the ram, that is to say Aries, is up above. And on the course of the pilgrimage to Canterbury, we find in this unfinished work that Chaucer, presenting himself as narrator and participant, is surrounded by every kind of individual who would make up the medieval world, of sundry persons who had chanced to fall in fellowship, an interesting passing comment, a passing line, because it is by chance as he presents it, but since he is the author of the work, it is by chance not at all indeed, but rather his contrivance, that a knight there was, and he a worthy man who from the moment that he first began to ride about the world loved chivalry, truth, honor, freedom, and all courtesy. And a squire, a youthful squire, a lover, and a lusty bachelor. And the prioress, a nun, who in her smiling modest was and coy, and never from her lips let morsels fall, nor dipped her fingers deep in sauce, but ate with so much care the food upon her plate that never driblet fell upon her breast. In courtesy, she had delight and zest. Her upper lip was always wiped so clean that in her cup was no iota seen of grease when she had drunk her draught of wine. And you can be assured from his description that her draught of wine she frequently drank, this prioress. As did the monk, one made for mastery, an outrider, who loved his venery, that is to say, hunting. A manly man, to be an abbot able. And so the friar there was, a wanton and merry, a limiter, a very festive man. The merchant, with forked beard and girt in motley gown, and high on horse he sat upon his head a Flemish beaver hat. His boots were fastened rather elegantly. He spoke his notions outright pompously, stressing the times when he had won, not lost. And a clerk, that is to say, an ecclesiastical student, who from Oxford was with us also, who turned to getting knowledge long ago. The haberdasher, the carpenter, the weaver, the dyer, and the arras maker. A doctor of physic in all this world was none like him to pick for talk of medicine and surgery. And then there was a housewife, come from Bath or near, who, sad to say, was deaf in either ear. Three times she'd made the journey to Jerusalem, and many a foreign stream she'd had to stem. In Rome she'd been in Boulogne in Spain, at Santiago and at Colonia. This is truly a pilgrim's pilgrim. And there was the parson, and there was the miller, and there were all these other individuals, each of whom proposes to tell a tale on the way out and a tale on the way back. But as you know, with Chaucer's death in the year 1400, this human comedy remained unfinished. It does, to the extent that he can give it to us, however, offer an extraordinary array and range of issues and ideas that define the 14th century and its concerns, that define the period that we find ourselves within, a period of transition between what we are wont to call the Middle Ages, the medieval period, the time between antiquity and the time of modernity, the 14th century between the medieval period and the Renaissance, a time that we define as such in speaking of it as emblematic of rebirth, renaissance, rebirth of classical ideas. Chaucer, like Boccaccio in his way, in his Decameron, Chaucer in his Canterbury Tales, offers us a range of issues and ideas by way of a range of personages that fill out the community with which we have been acquainted and through which we have been traveling, lo, these many weeks. When we turn to his contemporary, actually Dante is not quite a contemporary, because he's born in 1265 back in the 13th century and dies in 1321, barely is Chaucer a gleam in his parents' eye at that point. But we turn from the human comedy of Chaucer's focus and that of Boccaccio to the divine comedy of Dante, who, born into a politically factioned Florence and a Florence that itself is part of a factioned Italy, at war as much as it is at peace with Siena, with Pisa, in part of a kaleidoscope of constantly shifting alliances and misalliances. Dante, born into that politically factioned world, is consumed not only for politics, but with a passion for Beatrice Portinari, who died suddenly when he was 25, and who, with her beauty and her early death, inspired his early sonnet work, The New Life, the Vita Nuova, which he authored in 1292. But the two strands, love, eros, and politics, meet as a consequence of what happens shortly thereafter. Dante, politically active, reached a point of achieving a minor ambassadorship at the end of the 13th century, but because of the political factions within Florence, found himself ultimately exiled in 1302, and it was out in exile that he would ultimately immortalize Beatrice. That is, political exile gave him the need and the opportunity, backhandedly, to immortalize his love for Beatrice by immortalizing her and immortalizing himself in that magnificent work, The Divine Comedy. So moving from Chaucer and Boccaccio to Dante, we move, as it were, from one realm to the other, except that we are really moving between realms in all times, back and forth. The human condition as it is within our reality, the human condition as it pertains to that reality that awaits us at the end of our lives, and the divine concern and focus on our reality that we assume to be the backdrop for all activity. So Dante creates a narrative allegory, himself as the symbol of humankind, Virgil, the eminent Roman, Latin language, epic poet, as the symbol of human reason, a work that is a reflection not only of European spiritual history, but of Christendom overall and all its traumas and all its triumphs out of pagan antiquity, all its ambiguities and contradictions, a work that also reflects on the political issues, on the secular issues of Dante's time, as much as it reflects on the spiritual concerns of his time. It is the medieval work par excellence in its use, first of all, of a kind of logical style of argumentation that derives from Aristotle and which we have seen carried through Anselm and through Aquinas and through other medieval thinkers. It is medieval in its boasting of the author's knowledge of classical antiquity, that doctus learned, that doctus quality that causes him constantly to drop names and ideas that reflect his learning. It's a medieval work par excellence in the mystical quality of it, by which I mean there is no hierarchy that intermediates between the individual, the character, Dante the writer, and Dante the character in the poem that Dante has written, that intermediates between him and this other realm into which he enters with such intensity, in such complete contact. In that sense, a mystical quality, an intense personal experience, a personal individualized entrance into that other reality without the church to intervene. It is at the same time the beginning of the Renaissance in its way, as picking up its threads, Boccaccio in his and Chaucer in his way are also part of that transition into the Renaissance. It is a Renaissance work in that it elevates Italian to literary status, which theretofore had been the language only of the gutters and streets, whereas Latin, of course, had been the language used for literary work. He first began that with his Vita Nuova in 1292 and continues the development of literary Italian then in this masterwork. It's Renaissance as well, and this is key in showing the path, one might say, towards modernity, in suggesting that immortality is achievable by worthy actions in this world rather simply than by the grace of God. And in that sense, its focus on what I as an individual, what I as a human can do to achieve immortality is the beginning of that focus on human responsibility and role, which we will call humanism, which will be a defining feature of the Renaissance. In its structure, the Divine Comedy is as marvelously complex and carefully thought out as a Gothic cathedral. each of its three parts is stylistically different from the other. The Inferno has uglier language, and as one elevates from Purgatorio to Paradiso, one finds the very language that he uses, the style, the vocabulary, becoming lighter. Each of these three parts symbolizes a different aspect of the Trinity. The power of the Father in the darkness of the Inferno, the wisdom of the Son in the ascent of the Purgatorio, the love of the Holy Spirit in what is achieved, what is accomplished, what is arrived at in the Paradiso. Moreover, each of these three parts is divided into 33 chapters, 33 cantos, giving us a total of 99 cantos. And note well, 33 itself is, of course, 3. There's Trinity again. 3 times 11. 11 is the third prime number. So all of this play with the idea of threes is evident in the structure of the poem. 33 cantos giving us 99, except if you look carefully, there is, of course, an introductory canto in the Inferno, giving us a grand total not of 99, but of 100. 100, of course, is 10 squared. 10 is a perfect number. Why? Because 3 squared, 3 times 3 gives us 9. The Trinity itself squared, plus 1, which reminds us ultimately of the unity of God, gives us 10. So that divine unity plus the Trinity squared gives us the 10, which squared gives us 100, which is the number of cantos, which is actually 1 plus 33 thrice, giving us 99. This kind of thinking underlies its structure. And each, of course, of the cantos is divided into a series of verses, which itself is 3 lines long. In fact, this is his invention. It's called terza rima. And the end of the first and the end of the third line in each of these verses rhymes with each other. So that's the rhyme scheme. A-B-A, 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 and so forth and so on. It is an extraordinary work which carries him and us in the great ascent towards paradise, where Beatrice ultimately will guide him. Now recall I said a moment back that Virgil symbolizes human reason. And Virgil ultimately will leave him at the gateway to paradise. Virgil can go no further. Human reason can only carry us to a certain point. That sense of the limits of human reason, which is emphatic to the medieval period, and which appears to fade with the Renaissance, has surely not faded with Dante. He is aware of its limits. The supreme idea of Renaissance thought of reason he recognizes as limited, and so in a medieval sense of thinking, he rather carries us only so far with reason and leads us ultimately to Beatrice, who symbolizes divine grace, reaching down to pluck us up. This extraordinary work, this literary work of genius, is an epic poem, of course, and intended to be viewed thusly. It's not by accident that the guide who symbolizes human reason is the epic poet par excellence in the medieval sensibility, more even than Homer, the putative author of the Iliad or the Odyssey. Virgil, the author of the Aeneid, is looked back upon by medieval and Renaissance thinkers as the symbol of epic genius. And what is it that the poet as character within the poem experiences here? An adventure. An adventure every bit the adventure of Aeneas, every bit the adventure of Odysseus. The difference being, of course, that each of them, in the midst of an earthbound adventure, enters into, in the case of Aeneas, the other reality. Whereas the entirety of Dante's adventure is spent within another reality, which is described in enormous detail, as we have and shall see. It is an epic poem. It is, of course, a lyric poem as well. In the Roman tradition of Catullus and Propertius and Tibullus and others, the poet himself as the persona within the poem, the poet as a person within the poem, and the poet as the poet of the poem simultaneously. So then, in the absolute sense, we have the meeting of politics and love, Beatrice, his love object, his love interest, as the culminating principle of Paradiso, connecting and with his commentary on the political scene that we find throughout, so that those who were negative we find in the Inferno suffering for their negativity, that is, what he views as negative, and those whom he sees as positive we find in the Paradiso, or to the extent that they were accomplished in their positive way, we find them struggling upwards in the Purgatorio. Politics and love meet in the self in this epic adventure, which is, after all and above all, a poem about himself. This is Dante's Song of Myself. We find him led into a perfect setting. Dawn on Good Friday in the year 1300 in a dark wood, perfect conditions, under Aries, that is the same constellation that is the beginning of Chaucer's epic, that is the symbol of creation, that is spring, the beginning of things, at dawn, the symbol of rebirth, at the time of Easter, which is the symbol of the resurrection, at a time when the full moon is present and the sun is at its equinox. And if you search the calendar of the year 1300, which is its setting, you will find that there is never a Friday, much less Good Friday, when the full moon and the sun at the equinox coincide. So that this setting is simultaneously one that he extracts in its details out of the reality of his own experience and completely imagined, because it comes from in here, which is the analog of what is out there in that other reality. And so we find himself confronted by the edge of this, at the edge of this wood, by the leopard of malice and fraud, by the lion of violence and ambition, by the she-wolf of incontinence. And even as each of these figures represents then these different negative aspects of human capability, each of them is drawn from the vision that we find in Jeremiah 5. So there is a biblical underpinning to this. And each of them similarly symbolizes Florence, the city that has exiled him as the leopard, and France, the country whose interference in the politics of Florence and Italy is in part responsible for his difficulties, as the lion, and the papacy, the enemy that he sees as a symbol of greed and ambitious pride, who is the she-wolf of incontinence. All of these aspects of beastly reality are aspects of his experience, aspects of the world around him, and aspects of the ideas that swirl around humanity throughout its history. Midway in our life's journey, he tells us, I went astray from the straight road and woke to find myself alone in a dark wood. How shall I say what wood that was? And so he goes on. Death could scarce be more bitter than that place. How I came to it, I cannot rightly say. Of course he cannot, because this is, after all, in large part, something that is a dream, something that is within the realm of the imagination, something that is within that interior reality that corresponds to that external beyond reality of death and divinity, where things operate in time and space according to their own rules and not our rules, not the way things are when I'm awake during the daytime, during my lifetime, when I know that 1 o'clock will be followed by 2 o'clock, will be followed by 3 o'clock, when I know that it will take me less time, all things being equal, to get from Washington to New York than it will to take me to get from Washington to Paris. In that reality, out and beyond, and in that reality within that I experience in my dreams and can experience in my imagination, time and space operate according to their own terms. So how I came there, I cannot rightly say. So drugged and loose with sleep had I become when I first wandered there from the true way. He's at the edge of the woods, that is to say, a transition point between woods and whatever else it is. The whole thing, in fact, being out in the whatever it is, and yet at a transition between places, as he finds himself midway in his own life's journey at a point of transition. This is, remember, after all, a song of myself and what I experienced internally, spiritually, as much as what I tell you I experienced in what I'm about to write about. And it is as an offering for what all of us experience, himself as the symbol of humankind, that he writes forward to carry us out of the mistakes that we tend to make and back towards the true way. But at the far end of that valley of evil, whose maze had sapped my very heart with fear, I found myself before a little hill and lifted up my eyes. Its shoulders glowed already with the sweet rays of the planet whose virtue leads men straight on every road. And so he describes how I faced a spotted leopard. This fell at the first widening of the dawn as the sun was climbing Aries with those stars that rode with him to light the new creation. Yet not so much but what I shook with dread at sight of a great lion that broke upon me, raging with hunger, its enormous head held high as if to strike a mortal terror into the very air. And down his track a she-wolf drove upon me, a starved horror, ravening and wasted beyond all belief. I wavered back, and still the beast pursued, forcing herself against me bit by bit till I slid back into the sunless wood. So at the edge of the wood, by paradox, he slips back into it in flight from these three beasts. And yet slipping into the wood is slipping into the realm of darkness, the realm of fear, the realm of confusion. So from a path that is already away from the true way, he has told us, a path that is already confused, in order to avoid these three beasts as a symbol of all that is wrong, he slips further into confusion. But there at least he will find his guide, human reason, Virgil, who will lead him down in a descent towards the vestibule of hell, which we enter in the third chapter, the third canto. I am the way into the city of woe. I am the way to a forsaken people. I am the way into eternal sorrow. Sacred justice moved my architect. I was raised here by divine omnipotence, primordial love, and ultimate intellect. Only those elements time cannot wear were made before me, and beyond time I stand. Abandon all hope, ye who enter here. Immortal words. And so this is the beginning of this extraordinary adventure, which, to remind you, has its analog in that passage in the Aeneid, where, led by the Sibyl, Aeneas enters the underworld. In that passage in the Odyssey, where, met at the edge of reality and fulfilling the prescriptions that have been given to him, Odysseus conjures up at that edge all the individuals with whom he must speak to find out about his fate. Finding out about his fate is what Odysseus and Aeneas and here Dante are all equally about. Here into the underworld he goes, where they are mixed with that despicable corps of angels who are neither for God nor Satan, but only for themselves. The high creator scourged them from heaven for its perfect beauty, and hell will not receive them, since the wicked might feel some glory over them. At the entrance are those who have not been so evil as to enter into the depths yet of that underworld, but stand at its entrance, neither able to exit from it, nor quite damned and doomed with entering into its depths. And he moves through limbo, down through the first, to the second, to the third, to the fourth, to the fifth circle of this inferno, nine in toto, that is to say, three times three again, the Trinity in reverse, as it were, because this is the negative that leads us down towards Satan and not the positive that leads us up towards God. Past the virtuous pagans in limbo, towards those whose punishments fit their crimes of being too carnal, of being gluttonous, of being hoarders, of being wrathful and sullen, of being violent against their neighbors, or violent against themselves, or violent against God, or violent against nature, or violent against art. And if we assume that the deeper down you go, by the way, the worse it is, and the more nefarious your crime, then it is most interesting that those who are violent against art are further down than those who are violent against anything or anyone else. So as a poet, as much as a lover of Beatrice and a fallen politician, he writes, giving art status that is up, since one finds its detractors all the way down at the bottom of the seventh circle of hell, of the inferno. By the time we enter the eighth circle, we've entered the malbolge, where the fraudulent and the malicious are found. And then the bolge, the great hole, where the philanderers and the seducers and the flatterers and the simoniacs and the fortune tellers and the diviners and the grafters and the hypocrites and the thieves and the evil counselors and the sowers of discord and the falsifiers who are alchemists and the falsifiers who are impersonators and who are counterfeiters and who are false witnesses are found. Until we get to the center pit of Malbolge, where the giants we find, the description of which reminds us of yet another epic Greek poem, the Theogony of Hesiod, which you may recall has as its culminating pre-point of order to our reality the endpoint of chaos symbolized by the great war between the gods led by Zeus, who established order, and the giants and others who of the previous generation are symbols of chaos. He draws again, I remind you then, from a range of classical sources, even as he draws, again, I remind you, from a range of biblical sources, even as he draws from the politics of his own time and place, even as he draws from his own passion and love for Beatrice, even as he draws above all in this pyramid of sources, from within himself and from, if I may say so, a love of self that makes this ultimately the song of himself. He carries us down to that ninth circle, Cocytus, where those who committed compound fraud are found, where those who committed treachery against their families are found, where those who committed treachery against their country, even worse in his exposition than treachery against your family, are found, where those who are treacherous to guests or those who are treacherous to hosts are found. That principle of how one must behave with someone who has hosted you or someone whom you host is so strong for him and to him that he places such treachery even below that of betraying your country and that of betraying your family. That code is so important to him. And one thinks of a man who, after all, is, when he is writing this, in exile, as he will remain for the last 19 years of his life. He leaves Florence in 1302. He dies in 1321. He never, ever goes back to Florence in the course of that time. So we must understand how important the guest-host relationship must be to a man who spends the majority of his adult life in exile. He is, incidentally, buried in Ravenna, and while subsequently the Florentines would want the body back so as to reinter it in Florence, no doing, no going. He is by birth a Florentine, but it was Florence that betrayed him, Florence that exiled him, and with Florence that he would choose to have no subsequent relationship. One may visit Florence and visit the house that has not a trace of Dante in it, that is the house of his birth. But if one wants to find Dante, one has to go all the way to Ravenna. So moving down by way of the last several cantos, from Cocytus to its different parts deep in the ninth circle, we arrive in the penultimate canto to those who were treacherous to guests and host, and in the last to those who were treacherous to their masters. What a sense of awe as he arrives finally by way of Judas, Brutus, Cassius, the individuals who betrayed their masters, those who conspired against that father figure Julius Caesar, and he who betrayed Jesus himself. They are the figures found in the deepest depths of the ninth circle of hell. One can go no deeper than where they are except to the source of hell itself, and that source is Satan. With what a sense of awe I saw his head towering above me, for it had three faces. One was in front, and it was fiery red. The other two is weirdly wonderful, merged with it from the middle of each shoulder to the point where all converged at the top of the skull. The right was something between white and bile. The left was about the color that one finds on those who live along the banks of the Nile. This is John Chardy's translation, by the way. And you can see how he has wrestled to give us the terza rima by way of unsimple description. Under each head, two wings rose terribly, their span proportioned to so gross a bird. I never saw such sails upon the sea. They were not feathers. Their texture and their form were like a bat's wings, and so he beat them so that three winds blew from him in one great storm. It is these winds that freeze old Cocytus. He wept from his six eyes, and down three chins the tears ran mixed with bloody froth and pus. And I know that everyone enjoys these descriptive elements, so I always make it a point to include them. And you can understand the images of Satan that are derived from this text that we find in medieval and Renaissance art, and that derived from medieval and Renaissance art feed into this text. As he bade, I clasped his neck, that is to say, as Virgil bade, how are we going to now get to the end of this? We have been going down, 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 and finally find ourselves at the center of the center of the source of all evil. There with the huge and sinewy arms is the soul of Cassius. There is Brutus. There that soul that suffers most is Judas Iscariot. And as he bade, I clasped his neck, and he, watching for a moment when the wings were open wide, reached over dexterously and seized the shaggy coat of the king demon, then grappling matted hair and frozen crusts from one tuft to another, clambered down. When we had reached the joint where the great thigh merges into the swelling of the haunch, my god and master, straining terribly, turned his head to where his feet had been and began to grip the hair as if he were climbing, so that I thought we moved towards hell again. You understand the spatial problematic here. We have been going down, and presumably, in order to get out, we must continue down, and yet now it seems to Dante that we're climbing up. But how did up suddenly become down and down become up? Well, the answer is simple. Remember, we are in the realm of the other. And the realm of the other, be it divinity, or be it death, or be it dream, or be it simply what's inside his imagination, does not conform in time and space to the way our reality in the waking, living sense does. Up is up for us and down is down, but not in that other reality, where the two can interweave, intermix, and crisscross in a way that makes no sense coherent and intelligent-wise to us. Because indeed, we are within the realm that is beyond reason, which is of course part of the point and principle that underlies this whole work, that reason only carries us so far. And reason includes understanding down as down and up as up. But we will become beyond reason, whether in the negative sense where we find ourselves now, or in the positive sense, where ultimately Dante, without Virgil, that's precisely the point, the symbol of reason, and we, his audience with him, will find ourselves at the end, led by Beatrice to the upper reaches of the Paradiso. He began to grip the hair as if he were climbing, so that I thought we were moving back up towards where we had come from, toward hell again. "Hold fast," my guide said, and his breath came shrill with labor and exhaustion. "There is no way but by such stairs to rise above such evil." At last he climbed out through an opening in the central rock, and he seated me on the rim, then joined me with a nimble backward spring. I looked up, thinking to see Lucifer as I had left him, because we have just come down from there, even as we thought we were coming up. Well, we didn't know whether we were up or down. The point is, we're both neither up nor down. I looked up, thinking to see Lucifer as I had left him, and I saw instead his legs projecting high into the air. Now let all those whose dull minds are still vexed by failure to understand what point it was I had passed through judge if I was perplexed. Where was the ice? And Lucifer, how has he been turned from top to bottom? And how can the sun have gone from night to day so suddenly? And he to me, that is Virgil responding, "You imagine you are still on the other side of the center where I grasp the shaggy flank of the great worm of evil, which bores through the world. You were while I climbed down, but when I turn myself about, you pass the point to which all gravities are drawn. This is the physics of faith. You are under the other hemisphere where you stand. The sky above us is the half opposed to that which canopies the great dry land. Under the midpoint of that other sky, the man who was born sinless, Jesus, and who lived beyond all blemish, came to suffer and die. You have your feet upon a little sphere which forms the other face of the Judeca, that is, the area named for Judas, which they have just come through at the bottom of the ninth circle of hell, where it is evening when it is morning here. And this gross fiend and image of all evil who made a stairway for us with his hide is pinched and prisoned in the ice pack still. And so our hero, our poet, who is his own hero within his poem, ponders this. He first, I second, begin to move further to complete their passage out, to complete their passage down, to complete their passage up, to complete their passage in. He first, I second. Without thought of rest, we climbed the dark until we reached the point where a round opening brought in sight the blessed and beauteous shining of the heavenly cars, and we walked out once more beneath the stars. We end up beneath the stars. We end up out in night. We began at dawn, and now we find ourselves at night, and we will move in the course of the whole divine comedy from dawn through night and back to dawn, as of course we must, because that realm of the other is by definition the realm of night, when without light to give us a sense of space, or even eventually, if one exists in darkness long enough, a sense of time, things have their own shape, as they do in our imaginations, as they do in the dreams we find in sleep within the night, as they do in the realm that precedes and follows life, as they do above all in that realm of divinity, which is the author of all of this. By the time of Dante's death, we find ourselves embedded in the 14th century, the century of Boccaccio and Chaucer. We find ourselves moving between heaven and earth, as it were, between faith and reason, and find ourselves in the realm of music also in a new world called the new art, the Ars Nova. Organized polyphony has started to take shape. A new method of notating the motets has come into being in the 14th century. The little words, which I remind you is what motet means, the using of language to convey the message that instrumentation alone cannot, that has developed in the later part of the medieval period, begins to acquire a new method of notation associated most particularly with Philippe de Vitry, who is a younger contemporary of Dante, born in 1291, that would be the year before Dante wrote the Vita Nuova, and dies in 1361, which is a little bit before Chaucer has begun to author the Canterbury Tales. It is he whom we associate with this new form, this Ars Nova, as compared with, as contrasted with, the Ars Antiqua. And we are reminded of the complexities and complications of this time and place, this world of medieval Renaissance transitions, when we remember that 3 years after Dante's death, in the year 1324, the Ars Nova, as it had formerly come to be called, was condemned as heresy by the papacy. But by the papacy, which you may recall, is at that time not in Rome but in Avignon, where it has been since 1308 or 9 in exile, and where it will remain until 1375, 6, 7, or 8, condemned as heretical because this new style of music is deemed to have too much freedom of expression and therefore not succumb to that to which music should properly succumb, the kind of contrived and prescribed order that makes it a ladder of ascent from earth to heaven and a means of guiding us, as Virgil does, from our reality, which can take us off the true way, to the other reality and the proper path. Music that is too loosely constructed is music that won't do that job as far as the papacy of the 1320s is concerned. Nonetheless, of course, experimentation continues in many places. The most brilliant musical genius of the 14th century, for example, the Frenchman Guillaume de Machaut, is part of this period, who organized, who wrote very personal settings for the mass in the 1350s, mixing old and new styles of instrumentation, of harmony, or organization as it was still being called. And by the end of the century, by the time of Chaucer's death, the great cathedrals at Liège, at Cambrai, at Reims, at Chartres, at Notre Dame had choirs of 15 or 20 men and boys singing complex new music, that is to say, moving musically in the direction of the Renaissance. In the context of music that moves upwards, in the context of Dante's journey that carries him first down into the depths of the Inferno, and then up by way of the Purgatorio, this tremendously difficult mountain of ascent, for which the symbols in Renaissance art coloration will be red and black, black the color of evil, red the color of sacrifice, combined, offering that kind of symbolic visual vocabulary. A Purgatorio in which we join the poet in struggling upwards as opposed to simply ascending, and which leads ultimately towards a paradise, which is, in spite of the leadership that reason offers to us in the person of Virgil, carries us ultimately beyond itself, back in a sense to where we began, with faith. In the context of that thinking, in the context of the imagery of a Boccaccio and a Chaucer, who give us not the divine comedy but the human comedy, in which we have tales told by individuals and tales told about individuals that not only give us a day-to-day sense of the 14th century and a sense of its attempts to connection with that other reality, but in which we find implanted individuals whose purpose, whose job it is to make that connection for us, who are yet represented as earthy and earthly as the rest of us, so that the prioress of Chaucer, for example, who herself, recall, was represented as eating so carefully, who is in fact represented by him as being more concerned with how she eats than the fact that there are those around her who aren't eating at all, and who in her claim to be concerned about their souls and not their bodies, at the same time occupies herself quite clearly and carefully with her own body while ignoring the bodily needs of those around her. She tells a tale that is a tale of the power of an abbess, the power of the monastery, the power and principle of convent life, a tale of martyrdom, a tale of artifice, a tale that incidentally, in its negative anti-hero, offers us an image of the anti-Jewishness, the anti-Semitism that is part and parcel, by no means the totality, but part and parcel of this world. This kind of an individual we find as not distinctly different in her earthboundness from the knight who, in his tale, tells us a tale of chivalry that draws from the romance of the medieval period, as it is placed, his tale is, in the classical context, or different from the miller's tale, which gives us the conflict between the working man, the carpenter, and the kind of scholar who is another of the figures at the Tabard Inn in Chaucer's tale, who himself will tell tales, a story of cuckoldry and of base humor, or the story in The Wife of Bath of the conflict between wives and husbands, and the attempt on the part of the one to have power over the other, mixed with the story of guest and host relationship, which has been completely debased in that tale. And we know that could we filter The Wife of Bath's tale through the sieve of Dante's Inferno, then the individuals who are the actors in that tale we would find rather deeply embedded in the Inferno. Within the context of all of these contradictory and marvelously complex developments that we find expressed literarily and musically, and that will have their reflex in the visual art of the time as well, we find ourselves asking the question, where and when, precisely, we talk of bringing the curtain down for the period that we call medieval, as at the beginning of this series, we raise the question, where and when do we raise the curtain? At what point have we moved from antiquity into the medieval period? And there were so many aspects of the late Roman world which spill well into the medieval period, as there were aspects of medieval thinking which are already present in late Roman antiquity. We find ourselves here with Dante, and like Dante, at the other end of our own intellectual, well, is it an inferno, a purgatorio, or a paradiso, or all three at once, asking when the curtain should come down on the medieval period and when the curtain should come up towards modernity. We find ourselves led by way of diverse actions on a very complex stage to the issue of where and when. Somewhere, somehow, in the course, it seems, of the 14th century, between the time of Dante's Divine Comedy and the time of Chaucer's death at the end of the century, somehow in the course of the 14th, perhaps the early 15th century, new ways of thinking, new ways of looking at reality, new ways of hearing its sonorities, its rhythms, its harmonies, that is to say, its organizations, new ways of perceiving its orders, the relationship of its constituent parts to each other, have become increasingly apparent in Western Europe. It will be much later in the 19th century, when looking back to this period of the 14th and early 15th, that historians and art historians will see a renewal of interest in issues raised in pagan antiquity. It will be looking backwards from the perspective of the 19th century that, almost eschewing the ways in which the medieval world continues in mentality towards, and I would say unto and including our own time, that they will call this period of the 14th and early 15th centuries rebirth, renaissance, a rebirth and a renaissance of exactly what kinds of ideas, of exactly what kinds of ways of thinking and seeing, of exactly what points of view. That question is where we must move next in trying to understand where we are coming from and where we are moving towards in moving from what we think of as the medieval to what we think of as the modern world.